Revelation 17 is where we have left off. We got through Revelation 17, verses 1 and 2 last week. Today we'll go ahead and read these passages and then pick up with verses 3 and 4. It is information, I think, that we can do a reasonably good job with as far as trying to see the key points, the main points, but it is probably going to take a little longer to sort through some of this than some of the other chapters in Revelation. We've come to the section of the book, the latter part, which is material that requires, careful study just like the rest, but some extra details need to be explored from time to time. In 17:1, the text says, "And there came one of the seven angels that had the seven bowls." That would be the seven bowls of wrath, the seven plagues that we finished up with. "And spake with me, saying, Come hither. I will show thee the judgment of the great harlot that sitteth upon many waters." Anybody remember what the many waters are? All right, the people. We saw that it's about verse 15 in this chapter as you move down a little bit. And then, two, he says, "With whom the kings of the earth committed fornication, and they that dwell in the earth were made drunken with the wine of her fornication." And we went through that, and now the new material, verses 3 and 4, "And he carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting upon a scarlet-colored beast full of the names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet and decked with gold and precious stone and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations, even the unclean things of her fornication." Now, I've said, and we've made this point many times, but throughout the book of Revelation, we have a lot of contrasts. And it is the same old thing that we've talked about. You've got the saved, you've got the lost. You've got the light, you've got the darkness. You've got truth, you've got error. You've got God, you've got the devil. You've got Satan's followers, you've got God's followers. And this stuff is seen throughout the book of Revelation, but one of the big places where it's introduced is Revelation 13. And we keep going back there, and we keep going back there for a reason. Remember, we said, how can we easily remember where the two beasts in Revelation are found? Anybody remember? Well, okay, that's true. But as far as the chapter they're in, how do we remember it? It's Revelation 13. For a lot of people, that's that unlucky number. So this is one of the places where we see the contrast. Verses 1 through 10 of Revelation 13 talk about the first beast. And what's that beast? 13, 1 to 10? Evil, civil, government, or authority. And what's the second beast? Revelation 13, 11, then down through... Oh, okay, false religion. Verses 11 through 17 or 18, I don't remember exactly if there's 17 or 18 verses there. And John's going to continue to do that. We've seen the contrast from other perspectives as well. Revelation 13, if you're on the side of the beast, you're going to get what? You're going to get the mark of the beast. Well, not literally. But if you are a child of God, will you not also get the mark? Yes. There's a mark for the saved. There's a mark for the unsaved. All right, now here, as you look at Revelation 17, how many creatures do you see? Or how many key figures do you find in Revelation 17? Just what we read, verses 3 and 4.
Two.
All right, that makes you wonder a little bit. How many creatures did we have back then in Revelation 13? Two, same number. All right, and both of those creatures in Revelation 13 are described by what word? They're both beasts. All right, do we have the word beast used here in Revelation 17? Well, yes, we do. So the same number, and we'll offer some more comparisons to show points of similarity as we continue to go through the text. But we've got the same number. We have at least one of the powers here in Revelation 17 being described as the beast, just as we find in Revelation 13. So at least tentatively, we might wonder if the two beasts in Revelation 13, that is, evil civil government, false religion, are not also being described here in Revelation 17, only here in Revelation 17, John changes the figures a little bit. He still uses the word beast. I think that's partly done to clue us in. And then he also introduces this woman that's riding the beast, and we'll have more to say about her. Then we'll get down. Probably not today, but we'll talk a little bit about Babylon. I gave you some information as far as a handout last week. Next week, if you're not going to be in the class, let me know. Because next week I plan to lay out some things from Babylon, Genesis 10 and 11, that I think you'll find to be really, really fascinating. And it'll continue to pull a lot of this information together. All right, we have this woman. She's sitting upon a scarlet-colored beast. And these are full of the names of blasphemy. Well, if you think about the image of a woman, have we seen a lady earlier in the book of Revelation? Let's go back a little bit, a couple chapters. Revelation 12, we'll read about verses 13 down to 17, pretty much the last 20% of the chapter. He says, and when the dragon, who's that?
Satan.
All right, it's a devil. When the dragon saw that he was cast down to the earth, he persecuted the woman that brought forth the man-child. And there was given to the woman the two wings of the great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness under her place, where she is nourished for a time and times and half time from the face of the serpent. What do you think that woman is? That's,
Mary?
Well, okay, I think you've got some interpreters that would take that position. Let's read a little bit more and see if we come up with another idea. And the serpent cast out of his mouth after the woman as a river, that he might cause her to be carried away by the stream. And the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened her mouth and swallowed up the river, which the dragon cast out of his mouth. And the dragon waxed wroth with the woman and went away to make war with the rest of her seed. Mary might be one idea. Is there another possible explanation?
Church.
I think it's primarily the church here. There were some things that brought the church into the world, and now Satan is at war with that. So Revelation 12, we've got the image of a woman. Now over here in Revelation chapter 17, we again have the image of a woman. But would you say that as we look at these two passages, which both use the image of a woman, that we're dealing with the same kind of female? Exactly. And that's why I say when you look at John's writing, 1 John and especially the book of Revelation, you see these contrasts. It is 180 degrees. Truth, error, light, darkness, good, evil, sin, Satan, and now a woman. Righteous woman fleeing from the devil in Revelation chapter 12, over here in Revelation chapter 17, an unrighteous woman who is compared to a seductive prostitute. Now John, as he receives this part of the information, he's carried away in the spirit into the wilderness. Now this is the third time that John describes himself as being in the spirit. We saw it back in Revelation 1:10. We also see it in Revelation chapter 4, verse 2. And some people understand this as a literal carrying away. I'm not sure that it's required to be understood in that way. It simply may be a reference to a vision. At least I kind of favor that interpretation rather than him being bodily transported to another location, but I can't prove that. We're also not told why John was taken into the wilderness. I mean, John does include this detail. As far as exactly why this was done, I don't know. There are a couple of suggestions that have been put forth. When you think about the source or the place where this evil power is located, if you will. Maybe that's what is being expressed, that it's out there in the wilderness. This is the home base for its operation. Another possibility might be when you think about the wilderness, generally a place where you want to be on an ongoing basis or not. Probably not. So this may be also an indication that the future is not going to be very positive, very bright for this woman who's elsewhere described as Babylon and so forth. We do know that as John described the church back in Revelation 12:6, he also described the church or God's people as being in the wilderness. And when you think about Revelation 12, it may be that John is also suggesting that there's going to be a reversal in roles. Right now you've got the church in the wilderness, but a time is going to come. If he's not talking about this as being the base of operation, a time is going to come when the roles are going to be reversed. Anything that you might add or ask before we pick up with a couple more points? Try to break this down little by little. Okay, as John talks about this lady, how does he describe her? Revelation 17, 3 and 4. She's sitting on the beast. What else?
Scarlet.
All right, we've got...
Scarlet means there.
Okay, when you think about scarlet, you know the scarlet letter, if you've ever seen that book or you've read that story, on the cover, what color do you find?
Red.
It's red. And that's what we're talking about here. Now we've said, as we've gone through the book of Revelation, that numbers often have significance in this book. Have we also maintained that colors are also significant? Sure. I mean, you think about the color black in our society. What's that mean? All right. There's darkness. There's mourning. There's death. There's grief. There's pain. What if somebody tosses up the white flag in battle? What's that mean? We're coming to attack? All right. We're going to surrender. So colors oftentimes convey many, many signs. Thinking about this color. The woman has red. What comes to your mind when you begin to think about this lady? And we know she's unrighteous. As Stan said, she's the exact opposite of the woman in Revelation chapter 12. So, all right, I think you have those things. And when we think about the side of wrong and unrighteousness, we find a lot of ambition. What else?
Harlem.
All right. You know, we hear sometimes about the red light district. If you talk to some people, they probably need to be, I'm guessing 60 is probably going to be too young. But if you talk to people that are 70 or older, and 70 might even be too young, depending on where people live, they will tell you stories about how they actually lived in an area and they saw red lights. You know, it was a place for the prostitute. She puts the little red light, and I think that, I don't know the exact history, but I suspect that that's where the expression red light district came from. What else? Okay, that's a great point. We're going to pick that up in just a second. Let's go back to a passage that we're familiar with from the book of Isaiah, first chapter, verse 18. And then Virginia, since you kind of hit that other nail on the head, Revelation 12:3, if you'll go over there.
Revelation 12:3,
uh-huh. And then let's head somebody else over to Revelation 6, verse 2. Revelation 6, 2. You have a minute. All right, Josh, have a few minutes to get there. Isaiah 1, verse 18.
Come now, let us reason together, says the Lord. Though your sins are like scarlet, they shall be white as snow. Though they are red like crimson, they shall become like wool.
Okay, now we're familiar with that verse, but maybe that's not the passage that immediately popped into our mind. Isaiah 1, verse 18, scarlet or red? What's that color associated with in Isaiah?
Sin.
Unrighteousness. I don't think it's a surprise that over here in Revelation chapter 17, we have this woman who represents false religion, seductiveness. The color associated with her, at least one of the colors, is red. All right, and then, Virginia, let's take your reference, Revelation 12:3. Now, I will tell you, before she reads this, that the word translated red in Revelation 12:3 is not the same word that's translated scarlet over here, but both are colors of red. I mean, for example, if you go in and you say, I want white paint. You know, they're different shades, but it's still white paint. And this is the point when we deal with this color. Isn't it interesting that God could have, number one, simply eliminated any color when he described the devil? Could he have done that? Sure. And why didn't God describe the devil as being white or black or purple or green or orange or some other color? Why choose red? Well, the answer seems to be found in symbolism. When you go back and you look at this color, scarlet or red, Isaiah 1, associated with sin, Revelation chapter 17, it is one of the colors on this lady. And now as we look at Revelation 12:3, a passage that we've already gone through, we see it associated with the devil. Now, in contrast to that, and we could look at some other passages, but we'll just limit our study to this one. Revelation 6:2. Let's see what we've got there.
And I looked, and behold, a white horse, and its rider had a bow, and a crown was given to him, and he came out conquering and to conquer.
Okay, the conquering one. What color horse is he on?
White.
All right, it's not in a brown one. It's not in a black one, it is on a white one. So when we begin to think about this, even in terms of colors, you begin to see the kinds of contrast that we were mentioning a little earlier. So this is really significant. Now, I will tell you this. If you go back and you look at some old commentators, and I'm talking about 100 years ago or 200 years ago, or you maybe go back 500 or 600 years ago, you'll see some quotes like this. Scarlet, and as I said, this is a quote. Scarlet is the color of popes and especially cardinals. And another fellow from long ago said, the mules and horses which carry the popes and cardinals are covered with scarlet cloth, so that they may be properly said to ride upon a scarlet-colored beast. Well, a lot of commentators in the past used the book of Revelation to talk about Catholicism. And as we've said, I think John has some things in here that certainly relate to that faith, because it's not consistent with what we find in the New Testament. But I don't think that this is really a treatise on Catholicism as far as just that religion. Then there was a pope, Pope II, and this goes way back in time. He lived from 1464 to, or reigned, rather, from 1464 to 1471. He said anyone who, besides the cardinals, wore scarlet, they committed a punishable offense. So I think that's interesting when you look at Catholicism, that they have chosen the color red, but I would not, as I think about that fact, read too much into it. We have any red in here? Well, you're probably sitting on a red pew. And we look around and, well, I don't know, we've got some reddish rock up there and we've got some little red in the carpet color. And I know of some good, solid congregations. There's one in Fort Wayne. If you go into the building, I mean, it's red. I mean, their pews are red, their carpet is red, the stuff up front, I mean, they've got some red curtains, and I mean, that is a predominant color. So we would want to be very careful as far as saying, well, you've got red in your church building, we're going to run, because this is a place of the devil. But it is interesting to see what the Bible associates with this color, and also to see how people throughout history have tried to use this color to argue against some things. Okay, I'm going to stop again, see if there's anything that you want to address. Dan? That's an interesting question, Stan. If you associate that with sin, you might be able to connect that from the standpoint that this is a place that needs to be overrun. You know, God has decreed that you're unrighteous and you need to go. That would be the first thing that would come into my mind. I know I studied it out way back when, and right now I don't remember a couple of the details, but I think that would be one of the things that you could look at. But there was some significance to that color. So, if done.
I think you have a question.
When it was time to go against Jericho,
okay.
You've got the people coming in, they make the deal with Rahab, the scarlet thread over the wall.
Okay.
There is some significance to that. It's been many years since I've studied it out, and right off the top of the head, I don't remember all the significant things there, but one of the things that I would associate with that would be you've got the city, it's been evil enough that it needs to be overcome, and that thread may have symbolized that among some other things. Virginia?
Well, also, the twins that were born, Jacob and Esau, one had a red dress around his arm and hand when he came out.
If we go back, I'm thinking that we find a reference to reddish hair there. Had a hold of his heel. Okay, let's see. There's Isaac, Esau selling his birthright. It's got to be around Genesis 24. Is it 38:28? Okay. Would you like to read it for us?
When she was in labor, one put out a hand, and the midwife took and tied a scarlet thread on his hand, saying, this one came out first.
Okay, yes, thank you. So, Virginia gave it right. You got their reference to the breach in 29. So, yeah, and that would be another passage, Virginia, that off the top of my head, because that detail is included there, I would think that there is, you know, some significance to it. But when you begin to think about the color red or the color scarlet, more and more passages come to mind. So you could spend, you know, a Bible study session on that color and likely some others.
I said I thought it was red, but I wasn't sure.
Okay. Well, scarlet, you're in that same, it's like, you know, different tints, different color hues. You're in that basic category. You know, we've got, you know, whatever color you pick out, blue, purple, green, orange, yellow, little stronger, little lighter than some others. But you do have this reddish color coming up several times in the Bible. And, you know, you think about the color even that we associate with blood. You know, when we see blood, what color do we say it is?
Red.
All right. Jesus died, the blood was shed, and I think there's probably some symbolism there as far as we're cleansed from sin by his blood. So a lot there, but we're not going to go too far down that road lest we get off track. Okay, this woman, she's got the names of blasphemy on her. Well, let's go back to Revelation 13 for just a second. We see the seven heads and the ten horns over here in Revelation 17. And notice as we look back to Revelation 13, verse 1, he stood upon the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast coming out of the sea. He's got how many horns?
Ten.
Well, that's the same number that we read over here in Revelation 17. How many heads?
Seven.
And then he's also got the names of blasphemy. Well, these are you find some minor variations in the details, but essentially, that first beast over there, evil civil authority, is what we find over here as we deal with one of the creatures in Revelation chapter 17. And this is, as I said, additional confirmation that we're talking about the same thing, but just from the standpoint of a different symbol. Now, Revelation 17, the first two verses in the chapter talk about the kings of the earth. He says there in verse 2, with whom the kings of the earth committed fornication. Well, who would you think the kings of the earth describe? Evil civil authority. So he kind of helps us a little bit back there in verse 2 as far as saying we're talking about evil civil authority, they, you know, involved with fornication and so forth, so they're definitely not right as far as being in a good relationship with God. And if we compare that with Revelation 13, that parallels the first beast, evil civil government. And then as we introduce this next symbol in Revelation 17, 3 and 4, that's consistent with the second beast in Revelation 13, which is religious error, the ways of Babylon, which I said we're going to deal with a little bit more and provide some good parallels, I think, next week. Here, and we'll say a little bit more about this as we get down into verses 7 and 8 of Revelation 17, but in addition to color, we also have some things symbolized by numbers. So when John talks about the seven heads, and he talks about the 10 horns, instantly what should go through your mind? 7, 10, both of those numbers describe perfection, wholeness, completeness, great power. And then you tie in with that the idea of a horn. You've got an animal that's going to butt you. You know, bad thing to be butted by a kitty. But, you know, imagine if a kitty's got a horn. Well, probably out at the fair this week to, let people come in and check it out. But bad enough for the headbutt, but what if he's got a horn on him? It's going to stick you, right? So horn, and we've talked about this before, horn is an image of power. It is an image of authority. So when you take that image of authority and power and you join it with which two numbers? 7 and 10. What are you saying about the evil civil government? It's got a lot of power. Well, that's been true throughout time. Now they're talking about drones and some other things in our day and time. So what we're reading about here is not all that surprising. Then let's develop this point a little bit more. We have here the beast in Revelation 17, evil civil authority. Who's this woman that's riding the beast? Remember, we've got two powers, right? Evil civil authority and false religion. The two beasts in Revelation 13. All right, if the beast refers to evil civil authority, then this second figure or this second character, who is who? Okay, the woman who represents false religion. Why do you think John pictured false religion riding on top of evil civil authority? All right. Now, if you consider some of the things that take place in our time, I think you can see the point illustrated quite well. Does government ever try to get in bed with religion? Absolutely. Can you think of some examples? All right, historically, Catholicism got in bed with Rome. And when you look at that, if you wanted to, marry, got to get permission from the state, but that also is going to be a religious thing. So there was a joint partnership there. Sometimes it's been a matter of getting a job. You know, you worship our God, you worship our Caesar. Well, religion, state, and then you can get your job, and you can buy, sell, and trade, and so forth, as we've seen earlier in the book. What else? Especially in our day and time.
Well, it's my opinion, and I'm sure not everybody would agree with me, but that it is a lot of times grossly exaggerated, the separation of church and state that's in our Constitution.
Yeah. Well, we would like to see that there are basic Bible principles that our nation was founded on be taught, but a lot of times, and John's going to talk about this a little bit later. In Revelation chapter 17, he's actually going to talk about, let's skip down a little bit, since you made that point. It's going to be, let's start with 15. And he saith unto me, the waters which thou sawest where the harlot sitteth are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. And the 10 horns which thou sawest and the beast. Notice this, the 10 horns which thou sawest and the beast. Who are we talking about there? Who's this beast? Evil civil government. All right, just read it that way. Evil civil government shall hate the harlot. Who's the harlot? This woman? All right, it's religion. So you have here a situation where evil civil government not only hates the harlot, but the Bible says they shall make her desolate and naked and shall eat her flesh and shall burn her utterly with fire. So later in the chapter, John pictures a situation where evil civil government and false authority or false religion part company. But in the first part of the chapter, he says sometimes they join forces. Let's go back and ask that question again. Are there times, thinking specifically about America, since this is where we live, are there times where we see religion and government join together? They're partners. We had an example within the last couple days. President Obama said, we've got to do what with racism? We've got to eliminate it. And who can help us in that? Churches. If you want an example of the government partnering with churches, that's it. It's not the only time, though. When else does the government reach out to religious groups? And, you know, I realize that the cozy relationship here may not be quite as close as what Glenda mentioned earlier as far as Catholicism and the government, because sometimes, I mean, you know, you think about a person riding on the back of an animal, they're pretty well joined. But and sometimes it's just not that close, but you still see this relationship. How else does the government? Okay, now that would be an example, I think, of what we find a little bit later in the chapter where the government and religion are parting company. So we do find that. So we'll bring that example up again in a couple weeks. But let's think of examples now where the government and religion join forces. All right, very good. We've got two or three hands here. Bessie, I'm going to take you after Jeff and then Dolores to try to keep the order right. Natural disasters. There is a tornado, there is a hurricane, and the government says, we need the help of churches.
I was thinking about the same-sex marriage thing now. They're trying to convince the churches to teach this in direct violation of God's word.
Yeah. The government, you know, and I'm going to mention this a little bit later, but people say sometimes to us, I do not talk about two things.
Politics.
And religion. Why? Because people know that these, at least they know on one level, that these two forces are the most powerful forces in the world. Now that is excluding God and Satan. That's the message in the book of Revelation. And the book of Revelation says Satan understands that principle as well, that politics and religion, if you're going to affect a lot of people, this is the way to do it. So his interest is in corrupting government. His interest is in corrupting religion because those are easy ways to snare and keep people. Dolores, you had another thought? Yes. They will partner with religious groups. Sure. We will be glad to have you come in and study with our people and help them get back on the right road. And not all of that could be necessarily bad, but the main point here is these partnerships. What about poverty? If the government is going to try to make a war on poverty, you think they're going to reach out to religious groups? Under President Bush, remember there was the government spending that was designed to get into the hands of churches. The government was going to partner with churches. So this kind of stuff is not new. It's been going on for a long, long time. What about to decrease violence? Government says we have a violence problem in this place or maybe in this state or this area. We need to call, we need to engage in our religious leaders. And that's the kind of thing that John is talking about here. And as I said, it was especially cozy when you go back and you look at ancient Rome and some other cultures through time. And in some cases, that led to God's people being severely persecuted.
One other place is that in God we trust is on our money. That's such a prayer in Congress. And I think they say they have, the Lord, Moses isn't it over the Supreme Justice Department? The
Supreme Court.
Supreme Court is up over the building. They got a lot of people carved in, you know.
Yeah. Ten Commandments. You've got some monuments on government land where you have those. So, yes, you do see a connection. And it's not always been, if we look outside this country, it's not always been some kind of Christian faith. Other religious groups have been partnering with governments that are not trying to follow biblical principles for a long, long time. So when we begin to think about this, we can come up with all kinds of examples. So thank you for the good contributions. Anything else you want to add or ask before we talk about this lady in the clothing that she's got? Don?
I just thought of one. I mean, the doctor system that we have in the state of Indiana where allows
okay. Yeah.
kids to go to parochial schools with state money.
Yeah. So as I say, as you begin to kind of process this, you begin to say, well, hey, and the money was a good one, and so was the adoption. But, you know, all kinds of connections, because civil authority recognizes the power that is inherent in religion. So if this is one of the points that we've got to get from the book of Revelation. Let's see. Yes. You're exactly right. And history is filled with world powers that have done exactly that kind of thing. So we see these cycles continuing to come in slightly different forms, but it's basically the same thing. As Solomon said, there's nothing new under the sun. And that's... Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's been down this road before. Egypt, it seemed like they were out of control with the Hebrews. Also with the Hebrews, you've got Assyria, you've got Babylon, and, you know, Medo-Persia, and people thought they were going to be God and reign. I'm going to make this point again, but since you brought it up, just one more little chunk to think on for a little while. Why does God allow people to get to a point where it seems like they've got all this power? And the example I'm going to use, you're going to hear this sooner rather than later, but think about Goliath. If you go back to the Old Testament, how many days did he appear before the people of Israel? 40. Well, do you remember anything about 4? 10, a number of perfection, times 4, the number for man's world. There's some symbolism there. And anybody remember how many times he appeared to the Hebrew people over that 40-day period? He appeared morning and evening, 80 times. And here you have this guy, he's coming out for over a month, twice a day, taunting with people of God. And, you know, at that point, after 40 days, it looks like he's pretty much in control. And as you go back and you look at the other nations that were just mentioned, Egypt, you know, when you enslave people for 400 years, how much hope are you left with as far as getting out? I mean, it seems like they've won the battle. Assyria, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Rome, when you look at it, I mean, it basically controlled the ancient world. So it continues to get powerful and it continues to build and grow. And only when it seems to kind of get to the zenith, to the pinnacle of its power, does God step in and say, you're done. Down you come. Why wait that long?
To show his power.
I think that's right. And to demonstrate his glory. If God had knocked off Rome after, you know, the first couple people that they'd killed, well, okay, no big deal. But God says it's like a wrestling match. And I'm going to take you out when you're as fit as you can be. I'm going to take you out when it looks like you have come to the greatest degree of power that you have. And I'm going to show you who's really in charge. And that's what we begin to see as we start to go back and look at some of the history here. Okay, some other things that I do want to get to today as we look at this prostitute, this woman, that's sitting on the beast of evil civil authority. We'll say some things about blasphemy, but let's talk for a little bit about the way that she's dressed. Arrayed in purple, scarlet, she's decked with gold, precious stone, and pearls. What would you say about her wealth? I think she was doing pretty well. Question, false religion. Would you say that false religion has often been associated with wealth?
Yeah.
Absolutely. When you think about the health and wealth people today, a lot of money pours into their coffers. When you go back and you look at ancient America, you know, if you didn't show up on Sunday morning, they did some stuff to you that wasn't so nice. If you didn't show up on Sunday morning, you could be put in stocks. And they could also fine you. Now, can you imagine living in a culture where if you don't show up for Sunday morning services, you get assessed a fee? I don't know exactly if they took that out of your paycheck or exactly how it worked. But, you know, religion has done some interesting things oftentimes in conjunction with the power of the state, and it's not good. When we think about, for example, Catholicism, they've required money for births, marriages, prayers, funerals, masses, and so forth. So this kind of stuff has been going on for a long, long time. But wealth does not mean that a person or a group is in a right relationship with God, and that's one of the lessons that we can see here. And then, too, as you look at this dress that John describes, as you see this, if you were to go back and look at some of the ancient Roman writers, you would quickly realize that this is how prostitutes were attired in this day and time. Today, if you see a picture of a prostitute, sometimes it'll be splashed on a news magazine or maybe there'll be a newspaper clip, so-and-so was involved with this particular person. Sometimes you can see a pattern as far as how that individual is dressed. Prostitutes, and I mentioned this last week, you got the 100-year-old lady, she's dressed in dirty, shabby clothes, and she's all wrinkled up, What guy's going to say, hey, I want you? That's not the guy he's going to go looking for. Who's he going to look for? Pretty. Seductive. Attractive. Sexy. Do you think Satan applies that same strategy when it comes to false religion?
Sure.
Yeah. He's going to make it as seductive. He's going to make it as attractive. He's going to make it as appealing as possible so people do not realize that they are deceived. And yet John says if you go down this road, you're going to be involved with things that would fall into the category of blasphemy as well as abominations. Betty, did you have a point there? It looked like one of you were flashing your hands.
No.
Okay. All right, let's think about some of the ways. Oh, Stan, okay.
It says that she was arrayed in purple and scarlet. Is that an allusion to the connection between the false religion and the civil government? Because, am I not right here, purple was the color of royalty.
Yeah, I've got some information about that. I'll just go ahead and include that right now. I don't know that it could be exclusively tied to Rome, but it certainly does seem to have a direct connection to Rome. As you go back and you look at that, we've talked a little bit before about how people got the color purple. In some cases, they got it from a plant, from a root. That wasn't the best purple, but there was a root that was found in the eastern Mediterranean. The best source for this dye, though, came from a shellfish. And anybody, I've said this a few times over the years, but anybody remember how many drops of dye you got from that shellfish? One shellfish, one drop of dye. Well, if you're going to, dye some clothing and you've only got one little drop, it's going to take a whole lot of fish. So as we look at people in this day and time, the people who had colored clothing, I mean, it really did represent social status. Sources tell us that senators, I'll give you this quote, displayed a broad purple stripe on their togas. It wasn't completely purple, but it was just a swath, a large stripe. On their toga, that was for the male citizens. Lesser people had, on their togas, just a narrow purple stripe. It was the emperor who had a toga that was all purple. Now, today, you look at some of the bright colors, you see what Josh is wearing, you see what Adrian is wearing, Dolores, Sherman, Steve, Tim, Catherine, Molly, and Floyd, and Virginia. I mean, if they would have showed up in a first century assembly, they would have been the rich folks. Because of their clothing. You just didn't have the kind of color thing that we have today. I mean, you were lucky if you could get clothing. And if you did, I mean, it's going to be the color of the animal, which is probably going to be, drab, and the idea that we're going to have fancy patterns and stuff. So when he talks about purple and scarlet, yes, I mean, you do have the color here of authority, especially that was worn by people in the area of Rome. Let's go back to just a second and talk about the blasphemy. We generally, I think, don't associate the word religion with the word blasphemy. But here John joins the two together. Why would he do that? How can a religious person engage in blasphemy?
Well, it's false religion.
All right, it's false religion. Can you think of some examples today? If God says that baptism is required to become a Christian, Mark 16:16, Acts 2:38, baptism puts us into Christ, Galatians 3:27, and a person comes along and says, oh, well, you can just say the sinner's prayer. What have they done? Would you say they blaspheme? They have taken God's word and essentially says it's wrong. What about any of the other things when it comes to worship, Christian living? if this is God's message, and you're preaching another gospel, Galatians 1, verses 6 through 9, it is you versus God. And who do you think is going to win? God, in the end at least. You may have some success for a while, but the people who are, and there are just a ton of examples here that we could say. And not only this, think about some of the religious titles that have been used throughout time. We've talked about this a little bit from the book of Revelation. Some of the emperors wanted to be referred to as Lord, God, and so forth. What did the Bible say? What does the Bible say about religious titles? Matthew 23, verses 9 through 12. Call no man your father. And Jesus said, you're all brethren. You know, there is no place for religious titles. But a man comes along and says, well, I'm Lord God the Pope. Or you call me Reverend. Psalm 111, verse 9 talks about that word. It's the only time in the Bible that we have it, and it's associated with holy things, deity, rather than mankind. Or another person comes along and says, you refer to me as, your holiness or your eminence, your excellency, all religious titles, names of blasphemy or not. They are. So as John talks about false religion, there are a lot of things that are wrapped up here and some very, very practical lessons for us in our day and time. Now, there were some ancient writers going back several hundred years. One was fella in North Africa. He used this passage, I'll give you this quote, to warn Christians against an inordinate affection for sumptuous clothing. That probably is not quite what John meant when he was talking about this woman. I don't think the emphasis is so much on the clothing. And then some later Protestant writers found here, it was noted a reference to expensive crimson robes of the Roman Catholic cardinals. I think those applications are interesting, but it's doubtful that John had those points in mind when he was writing this material. Anything that you want to add or ask before I make one more quick point? Okay, let's think about this golden cup. If you have a golden cup, somebody's holding it up, what conclusions would you draw about that cup? All right, I think it's pretty. All right, it's special, it's going to be valuable, and it's probably going to, at least in the minds of most, be something that is attractive and for some perhaps desirable. Here, as you think about this woman, false religion, she's holding up her cup. What do you think the image is there? What's that point saying? I'm having a good time or I'm having a bad time? I'm having a good time. And look at what is going on here. It's almost an invitation to join the party. But John says, what's in the cup? Abominations. If you decide to join this satanic party, if you decide to become involved with false religion, there are going to be some consequences which are very, very undesirable. Now let me show you this too. I'm not sure that John had this in mind. Maybe he did. Revelation 5, verse 8. We were there a long time ago. And this is one more example of how you begin to look at the book of Revelation. Is greatly eased as when you begin to make some parallels. Got the prostitute, this woman, this false religion with the cup of abominations, this golden. Somebody want to read Revelation 5:8? Jeff?
And when he had taken the scroll, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb, each holding a harp and a golden bowl full of incense, which are the prayers of the saints.
Now, it doesn't use the word cup, I grant, but it uses the word bowl. So here you have a golden container in Revelation 5:8 being associated with what? God's people, the prayers of the saints. Now, several chapters later, Revelation chapter 17, we've also got a golden container, but now it's the opposite. It's kind of like what we talked about with a woman. There's that righteous woman in the church, Revelation 12. Now over here in Revelation chapter 17, we've got another woman. So sometimes John will use the same symbol in contrasting ways. Sometimes he's going to use other things to continue to demonstrate the ongoing war, the ongoing battle between good and evil, righteousness and unrighteousness, truth and error, all of these things. And if you get in the habit, as far as looking for these kinds of things, it will help you as you study the book. One other quick point, and then we'll shut it down for today unless you have a quick question. The word unclean is probably going to be translated filthiness in some other translations. The King James translates it in this way. The word is elsewhere used to describe evil spirits, idolatry, sexual sin. That usage is in Ephesians chapter 5. And the word fornication is one more reminder that the people who decide to live in the way that is consistent with this woman or the beast, evil civil authority or false religion, they're not going to fare very well when it comes to God and spiritual things.